welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. My guests today are Rick Rhodes and Jonathan Lamb of EQS Capital and EQS Trading Signals. And let me give you a little bit of background about these guys and EQS before we get started. Richard Rick Rhodes is the president and founder of EQS Capital Management, LLC. Rick holds a Bachelor of Science degree with honors in mechanical engineering from Texas A&M and an MBA from Duke University. He brings almost 25 years of diverse energy experience, covering all phases of the oil and natural gas value chains from producers to end users. He holds a licensed Series 3 commodity trading advisor credential with the Commodities Future Trading Commission and is a member of the National Futures Association. He began his professional career on a drilling rig in West Texas with Conoco Exploration and Production. Rick continues his oil and gas career with Koch Industries. I think we're all familiar with Koch. And he worked there in midstream refining pipeline and distribution operations. And during his 8 years with Koch Industries, he began as an operations engineer and found his true passion later in the process was trading, where he leveraged his interest in mathematics and economics with his experience in the energy industry. In 2002, Rick joined Duke Energy, and he spent 10 years with them in the energy trading department, earning their Pinnacle Award, which is the company's highest honors. He left Duke Energy in 2012 and started EQS Capital Management. My second guest is Jonathan Lamb, and he's a returning guest. He's been on here before talking about economics and millennial issues, and he is currently the Director of Business Development at EQS Trading. He was a four-year varsity hurdler at the Ball State University, and he earned his bachelor's degree there in risk management, insurance, and economics, and began working on his PhD in economics at North Carolina State University before focusing on business and trading. He was one of the first waves of millennials to join the workforce, and his professional career of almost 15 years began at ACS Power Marketing as an operations specialist providing demand-side economics for co-op power providers, and he became a real-time electricity power trader. He continued his trading experience for 7 years with Progress Energy's trading floor, which became Duke Energy, the largest utility in the nation, and he was a senior real-time electricity trader. He left the floor to become an entrepreneur and started a consulting firm specializing in finance and economics. And he has owned and run seven different small businesses before he joined EQS this year. And these gentlemen have diverse background and are able to help us understand the commodities market. And that's what EQS Capital Management does and EQS Trading Signals. They put out a newsletter, which I get every week, and I enjoy reading it to see what they think is going to happen with the commodities market. And I want to welcome you gentlemen to the show today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So let's start by kind of talking about your backgrounds and how that translates into giving this information to us plebeians who are not traders and don't go out and analyze the market, or you also provide it to hedge funds and others that are experienced. And so what is it that you look at in the commodities market? How do you assess it? How do you look at the general stock market and those things? And how does that play into your analysis of, and the information you present?
Sure. Lee, I'll just begin. When I was with Progress Energy, one of the things that we used to do as an oil trader is we had, if you added up the basically just simplified the business, we had power plants that used over $1 billion in natural gas, coal, and oil usage. And so it was our job basically to not only procure the oil, make sure we had it to keep the lights on, but we had to buy it at the right price. And the decision to buy it at the right price could save the company hundreds of millions of dollars, or if you bought it at the wrong price, it could cost the company hundreds of millions. So the process that happened there was very challenging. We developed a disciplined methodology, and we had the luxury of getting research from over a dozen different investment banks, which we would pour over research every week.
What kind of research did they provide?
It was mostly economic-based. And you might think, well, how is that important to commodities? Well, when the economy is booming and things are going very, very well, people have more money. They have more jobs. So there's more people on the road driving to work. They're consuming more gasoline. Industries are booming. They're producing more gadgets and things. And all those inputs cause an increase in demand for commodities. Conversely, when the economy falls and it's in a recession, things crash. The demand for commodities crash. So when we pored over that research, we learned the tie between economics and commodities and how that impacts the demand outlook. And over the years, we got quite good at it. We talked about that the Progress Energy fuel bill was over $1 billion. Well, in 2008, we had the luxury of managing things so that we could cut their savings down to, you know, over $100 million. And even during the financial crisis, when things came off quite a bit and oil prices crashed, we did lose money, but it was small in comparison to what we gained. And then we ended up buying more at those low prices to profit later in 2010, 2011, and 2012.
So can we translate that to what the listeners would be like when we go to the gas pumps and we see the price changing day to day? Is that what's translating essentially to when you're in the electrical generations field? That it's sort of that way. You're out, you're buying the commodity, you need to supply it. You can't make the price adjustments, though, as a power company automatically, like they can at the gas pump. But we're kind of seeing those fluctuations in the prices and the commodity purchasing immediately at the gas pump, not so much on our electric bill.
Right. And so, the main thing is one way to reduce the cost of these items is to go out on the futures market. And when prices take a dive, the futures market can allow you to lock in fuel prices for many years in advance. Normal consumers can't do that. I mean, they're seeing the day-to-day price fluctuations when they fill up their gas
right.
tank. They don't have access to, you know, buying fuel 3 to 5 years out in advance like we do. So with EQS, one of the things that we do with our newsline is we try to get out and communicate with different businesses, institutions, traders, hedgers on what we feel the direction of prices are going. And we do that through our product, which is called the Economic Quantitative Strategy. And to put things very simple, it takes all the information that I used to look at Progress Energy, compiles it in a very logical form, and it prepares an analysis that basically says, is the economy favorable for commodity consumption? When you look at industrial production, when you look at the housing market, when you look at the labor market, are those conditions booming enough to where the economy is at a rate to where we're going to consume more?
So you're essentially looking at the supply and demand curve across a lot of different products, the commodity products,
right,
and seeing how the consumer, how businesses are out there saying, yes, we're going to be buying more. No, we're not. Our confidence is uncertain, so we're not spending. We're minimizing our purchases. You're taking all that kind of market data, buying patterns, and taking it into your model to say, okay, based on this, this is what we think with regards to commodities, gold, silver, oil, natural gas, etc.
Exactly. And the economy plays an important part in the demand outlook for commodities. Now, what I haven't spoken about is the supply outlook. And when you compare supply with demand, if obviously you're using more than what you're producing, prices are going to go up. If you're producing more than what you're using, prices are going to go down. For example, here's just one to look at, but in mid-2014, right around July, oil prices were over $100 per barrel. The EQS model, which compiles all this data, started beginning to see a trend that we were producing more supply than we were using. At that point in time, it became negative on prices. It indicated that prices were headed lower.
Okay.
This recommendation continued until early January, when prices collapse to the mid-40s. So the system basically looks at those balances and determines on a long-term basis where things are headed. So if a person wants to invest in commodities, such financial advisors have a certain percent of their portfolio in energy companies,
right,
energy stocks, which move to the somewhat same nature as oil and natural gas prices. They use us as a reference and understand, well, have prices bottomed? Are they moving higher now? Well, we can tell them what our outlook is, and that allows them to be more educated on when they buy the stocks for their portfolio for their clients.
So when we're looking at that, because we love to go to the gas pump and see the price down, our dollars going further. But if we're an investor, let's say we have oil and gas investments and those kind of things, when we start seeing that check come in and it gets that royalty check and it gets smaller and smaller, we start seeing that trade-off. So when our portfolios are out there and prices are going down, it has an effect on the markets and our investments and the money that we have available too. So we have to look at both sides as a purchaser and as a supplier, right? So when we're looking at that and see those trade-offs.
Right. So on an economic data standpoint, we often look at the commodity market as a leading indicator of what we're going to see in the broader quote-unquote market.
Meaning stock markets and all those kind of things.
Correct. So the market is everything that surrounds us. And so when we start seeing these things, we look at a leading indicator, and as Rick just pointed out, you know, oil has taken a downslide, and I think we're starting to see that volatility and that noise. Our normal everyday investor is starting to take notice in what's going on, and they're pretty important factors that are going on in the economy all around us that are contributing. And in this case, just so happens that oil demand has fallen, and it's hurt a lot of things. And what we're really seeing is we're a smaller and smaller world that we're living in, is that we're seeing a lot of foreign demand. You hear a lot of
right,
talk about
so China.
Right,
so China's correct, chasing all kinds of natural resources.
So right. So as that Chinese economy starts slowing down, you know, we are in a very small world, and that global demand really puts pressure on prices, and those prices trickle down to the consumer. And you know, it seems like as a consumer, it takes a long time for us to see those prices at the pump come off, which is what we're all concerned about. But as investors, and that was what we do at EQS on the hedge fund side, is we analyze all that data and look at all that data to provide hedges and investment opportunities for returns.
Well, and we're looking at broader pictures, but we know some of the factors that have led to the excess supply, let's call it that, is the fact that we started going after oil shale and things like that because the price was high enough to justify the expense of that kind of exploration stuff. And then we saw the Middle East react and say, well, we don't want you to be, United States, to be the number one producer of oil and natural gas, so we're going to ramp up, we're going to put more in there, we're going to lower our prices, and then that starts playing with the market. Supply adjusts then because new wells don't get drilled here. Ones we have keep going. But that kind of ebb and flow is a natural part of
right,
this pricing in the marketplace.
And so what people don't realize, and as economists, you know, everyone thinks we're really boring and
well,
to some extent.
No,
but really, economics is what drives, you know, more than the economy. It's what drives the world. And economics is very simply, people try to complicate it, and we hear them talk about it on Wall Street, and we hear them talk about, politicians talk about the economy. There's so much more to it in economics, and it's just really simple supply and demand. And so how much oil do we have out there, and how much do people want to buy of it, or how much of any commodity?
Right, and as price goes up, people will get into the businesses to supply more. As price you get more out there, price normalizes or goes down, and the market naturally finds that intersection of supply and demand, allegedly without interference of government regulations and other things.
Right. And so what the beauty of the EQS system and the EQS model is that we take that guess out of it. We take that human intervention, because everyone plays off their own emotions. And what the model does, it's a very non-emotional. We take all the data and we say, yes, things need to go in this direction because that's what the data says. And so that's really the beauty of our system, is that we help traders understand that. We help traders take that second guessing and that emotion out of their trading. And we help provide them information to make profits off that in either a rising or a falling economy.
Yes, and Jonathan nailed that very nicely. And one of the things that that traders and investors deal with is emotion. And it's a big problem because when you have positions on and you've taken positions to improve your profitability or to hedge your price risk,
right,
when things start going against you, fear starts setting in. And then when things are going for you, greed starts setting in. And those two things can really impact your performance as a trader.
And your reasonable decision-making.
Your reasonable decision-making. So what EQS does is it takes the data. Data does not lie. It's not emotional. It's not greedy. It tells you exactly the way things
stand. It reflects what somebody did, that it may have been greedy, but yeah.
Yes, it reflects that.
Right.
So by doing that, we're able to incorporate a methodology that presents things in a educational way that describes why the market is behaving the way it is. And touching on your example, which is a great, just a brief precaps of the oil market, is back, 10 years ago, OPEC and the Saudis were basically the dominant player in the oil market. And it's amazing that we were importing most of our oil from overseas, because that's where they had the
They pretty much had a monopoly. OPEC
they had
did.
The monopoly. So then the shale revolution happened, 10 years later, and our production increased significantly. As a matter of fact, if you look at the numbers, in about 10 years, we've almost doubled our production capacity, and we've become the number one producer in the world. So the story is when you're OPEC and when you're Saudis and you look at this and the United States has stolen that market
and
share.
Right, the cash register is not ringing as frequently.
Right, their strategy changes. And before, their strategy was to cut back production in order to stimulate prices so they would rise and they would make more money. Well, now that the United States is the swing player, that strategy doesn't work. So one of the things we're dealing with right now in terms of falling prices is they're pumping even more.
Yeah, they're flooding the market to drive the price down, to drive the new drillers out of the shale market, because now it's not cost-effective economic. The economics no longer work to explore and drill more shale wells.
It doesn't work except for them, because they are the lowest cost provider. And if they continuing pumping, they will be the last man standing. And so that's the strategy. And it's a normal business strategy. People in the private market use it, in the public market use it every year. But it's used in the oil market, and it's working. We're seeing bankruptcies. We're seeing
a lot of job losses in that market.
Job losses in the economy. And things have come off. And at this point in time, because we've seen such a decline in prices, I think what's every normal person is thinking right now, well, when is oil prices actually going to rebound, and when are they going to rise, and what are the factors to watch for? And that's what we're gathering data on. We are starting to finally see production in the United States, which has grown so much, plateauing and coming off. Occurrence happens, and we believe in 2016 supply will come off significantly, and the big wild card will then be demand. Will it have a soft or hard landing? How does that contagion ripple over to the United States, which has shown fairly stable demand? The GDP was upgraded to 3.9% in the second quarter, so the demand outlook here, but Jonathan pointed out demand is soft. It's when you look at China, he's right, because they're the second largest consumer of oil at this point in time, and if they have a hard landing, that's going to definitely impact the global demand outlook for oil. So right now we're in a kind of a tready situation. We think that the worst is over in terms of production coming off, and we're going to start seeing tightening in 2016, but we're very much in tune with the global economy to see if it can just remain stable and prevent itself from going into a recession so that that part of the equation doesn't cause a further collapse.
So when you're looking at your model, do you also take into consideration the risks of war and like the Syrian war, ISIS, terrorism, all of those kind of things get factored into the model, or is it just purely economics and prices and all those kind of things?
The luxury about EQS is we are an actively managed firm, which means we don't put investments and a strategy in place and watch it for months. We have, between Jonathan and I, we were watching the news every single day. It's on all day long. We have all of our screens up on every market around the world and in the U.S., and we're seeing how those events impact what we do. So
Jonathan, are you still watching 8 or 10 screens at a time?
Yep.
Okay. Just checking.
More than that?
Okay.
So what I mean by active management, yes, those events are taken into consideration, and we do have an input for those types of things that go into the system. And you would be surprised that, and a lot of times, you can calculate if a certain amount of supply is being taken off the market because ISIS, controls a certain refinery now.
Right.
You can estimate those barrels and how they're coming off the market and what's that going to do.
Iran getting the sanctions lifted and they'll start pumping theirs and selling theirs in the open market, those kind of things.
So Iran becomes a very big news story. It's certainly going to play into the whole global economy and what goes on. Russia is another good example. What's going on? We were talking about that on the way over here. Exactly what's going to happen with Russia and their economy has certainly been hit because, as Rick pointed out, as oil took a slide this last year, the rest of the commodity sector has followed it, and it primarily points to a slowdown in the Chinese economy, everything from copper to all the other inputs that the Chinese economy really boomed over the last 10 to 20 years as they built out infrastructure, built new cities, built new buildings. They used all these commodities.
Well, and then more production went online for our electronics and all those kind of things. So silver and all those commodities, gold, speaking of gold, everybody buying up gold as a hedge.
Right.
China's been one of the biggest buyers of gold, India, all of those countries.
Right. So we're seeing that this whole sector get hit. Gold is a little bit different. It moves a lot. Rick can certainly attest to it and talk about, we see a lot of the things in the market balance with the gold and the dollar. We hear a lot of talk that as we get heated in the presidential election, we hear a lot of rhetoric about devaluing the dollar and jobs and all those things, and they all relate. And they certainly play in a lot to that commodity. And as we said earlier, commodities are, kind of the precursor. They're that canary in the coal mine,
right,
as you would understand from West Virginia.
You had to get that in there. So for those of you who don't know about canaries and coal mines, in the old days, the miners used to keep a canary in the coal mines with them because the bird is more sensitive to the poisonous gases that would build up. So when the canary died, they knew the humans had to run out very quickly or die soon after. So that's the canary in the coal mine.
So that's the canary in the coal mine. So as we watch this commodity sector in general start losing value in large chunks, it puts pressure on the rest of our quote-unquote markets that we talked about earlier. And so that trickles down to the stock market.
Well, we see the fluctuations in the stock market now. China took a header in that day, and almost our stock market went down at one point over 1,000 points.
Right.
Recovered. It goes up and down a couple hundred points here and there. Yesterday it dropped below 16,000, but recovered a little bit. So we see that volatility and that anxiety growing in the markets.
And that's what we talked about earlier when Rick hit the nail on the head when we talked about fear really sparking the market and people doing, playing off their emotion, that fear and that greed. And what markets don't like is uncertainty. And we have a lot of uncertainty right now in the global economy and in our own economy, And then again, I hate to keep bringing up political stuff, but they're hitting on it right now.
Right. Well, jobs, the economy, we're at the largest percentage of our population not working in history, right? Over a third of the people are on some kind of form of welfare. People are unemployed and underemployed. So they enjoy the low price at the pump, but if there were jobs out there, a higher price at the pump wouldn't hurt as much if everyone had work. There would be changes, as I alluded to earlier, barring influences on supply and demand, a free market, there are no influences. But political things are
right.
Tax policy, economic policy, what's the Fed going to do, what's the next president's budget going to look like, which administration is going to be in charge. All of those kind of things come into play, and that always becomes uncertain during that year that we have all of the elections and the infighting, backfighting, and the more people that are in the race, the more that uncertainty manifests
right.
itself.
So uncertainty drives fear, and fear drives volatility, and that's what drives price action and people doing things that they normally wouldn't want to do and make bad decisions. And what we do through EQS, you know, we use our quantitative model to take that step out of the equation and use that to trade the markets. And we provide a clear signal every day. Through EQS Trading, we have a daily subscription letter that comes out to everyone who subscribes. And a kind of a shameless plug here, but you can certainly go online at EQS and sign up for a free subscription.
And go to EQSTrading.com?
Correct.
And get the newsletter subscription.
That's right. So we provide a weekly newsletter that gives insight into a little bit deeper in some economic things that are going on in the broader economy, in the world economy, that are going to change and affect commodity prices. And then we have commentary based on individual commodities, oil, gas, so the fuels, the products.
Well, and I think any business owner wants to look at something like that, because in the broader scheme, whether you're Wall Street or Main Street, those things trickle down and affect your business. So getting it, I like to get it, open it, and take a quick look at it when it comes in to say, okay, so what? I'm going to look at it, and I'm going to say, well, what do I think the stock market's going to do today, or what is it going to affect this client doing business in China or that client?
Just to echo what Jonathan said, he you know, when he was talking about the trading recommendations that we publish every day, we just to add to that, we also publish the day we actually enter the recommendation. We provide a tracking of the profit and loss the recommendations made.
Right.
So that the end of the month, the subscriber can see, okay, well, I'm paying this much for the subscription. Is this making me money? So it provides a legitimate track record that they can view. And the research that what is the name of it's EQS Signals, it is a little bit different, so unique from our competitors, is that it's concise research. A lot of the things that, since I was a Progress and I poured through the mounds of investment bank research over the years, it tends to be long, dry, and it never gets to the point.
What it kind of takes you back to your undergrad economics
yes.
class if you
yes.
weren't an economics fan.
So in about 15 minutes per week, you can read our newsletter, and you can become up to date on the most important factors driving the commodity markets and the global economy. And with that, at the end of the day, you get a hardcore recommendation as to what to do. And those recommendations are tracked in terms of P&L so that the reader can get a confidence, okay, is this the right decision over time?
Well, and it's, you know, it flashes into my mind, you could get that and before you actually started trading. You could subscribe and you could have your own fantasy economic forecast like we used to do in college where you picked your stock portfolio to see who
right.
performed the best. But it's, you know, it's kind of an assessment there. And it's like I frequently tell clients that are smaller to go look at publicly traded companies' annual reports, because they're going to have an economic outlook. They're going to analyze economics. If they're in Duke Energy or someone, there's going to be things talking about what they think the trends are in the future and what influences will come in. And then you guys are providing the real-time, day-to-day type things of this is what happened yesterday, so this is what it means today.
Right. And so oil becomes a great indicator of our broader economic satisfaction or dissatisfaction. So
our activity.
Right. And it's becoming more and more correlated. And so what that means to our listeners is when it's correlated, it means that when it does something, something else happens. So when, for the most part, when oil goes up, the markets view this as a good thing because that means everything's great and let's have a party. It means that production is great. It means the oil market's booming. That means our factories are going to be producing
oil. Demand's
oils.
There.
Right. And so
demand that, means activity.
Exactly. And so as that rallies, our markets tend to follow that, whether it be our American stock market or our foreign stock market. So it's a great indicator of what's going on and what's going to happen. So you look at that in the futures market, you may see overnight, you know, we may send out a tweet that
okay, I'm going to interrupt. Explain what the futures market for anybody who doesn't know what a futures market is.
Sure. So the futures market is, a lot of people don't know that when you look at the stock market, you can buy and sell, you know, any stock like Apple, ExxonMobil, those types of things.
And you can buy or sell anything you don't already own, too.
Exactly. So a lot of the things with the commodities futures market is very similar to just the stock market, except you can buy oil, you can buy cattle, you can buy corn.
Any
commodity, and you can buy and sell it financially and settle just like stocks do in the stock market. The only difference is that you have to buy and sell it in larger quantities. So
you're not going to be 100 shares. You're going to be 100 million shares.
Exactly. So the value of our book of business or the value that we have to manage has to be larger to account for that. And so we have gotten around that by developing a pool, and we have a hedge fund pool called EQS Commodities Fund, which allows us to aggregate investments from a number of different institutions and private investors. And so that when we go out in the market and we buy and sell commodities, we can manage larger chunks and divide it up into percentages and the amounts that the actual investor owns.
So you're leveraging and pulling funds from different investors into your, so that you can go from being 100 shares to 100 million shares.
Exactly.
And by what one could not do on their own, you're able to do in this combined fund. And then a proportional share is owned by people participating in the fund.
Exactly. It allows people that don't have the expertise in commodities and the money to be in the futures market to actually do that. So it's a great thing. One of the other items I'll point out is a lot of people sometimes think because oil prices are crashing that, your fund must just be doing terrible, or, you know, things are just not good right now.
It depends on what you bought in the futures, right?
It depends. And you can buy futures and you can watch them rise and you can make a profit, or you can buy and watch them fall and make a loss, of course. But there's also the option to short. And
I was going to ask you that.
A lot of people don't understand that, but it's really just the reverse process of buying. If you feel like a commodity is oversupplied like oil was in July of 2014, you can short it and you can go out and just sell the market ahead of time and buy it back once it reaches a lower price.
So essentially you're going to sell what you don't have and buy it when you want it.
When you want it
back. At the lower price.
At the lower price. And it's the same way to make money except in the reverse process.
So it's kind of like one of those famous billionaires that's always shorting the value of a dollar or the British pound or whatever when he's out there, and has been known to bring down entire economies by shorting and betting against a currency.
Correct. So what we provide at EQS, EQS Capital in itself, like Rick said, we're actually a hedge fund, and hedge funds certainly get a bad name because hedge funds, in by definition, were originally put in place as a hedge, and that's a lot of what
it's a hedge against risk.
Right.
Okay.
And so it has grown to be, use this term that we broader think of it in the equities market, and we're hearing about it in presidential debates and everything else. But what EQS Capital does is we provide those investors with hedge. So through our hedge fund, you know, they can invest and take advantage of those prices, the movements in both an up and down market.
So hedging is risk diversification, essentially.
Correct.
So you're offsetting one risk with another type of investment, and so you even out and smooth that out.
Correct.
Right. We may be long a basket of commodities.
Meaning you're betting high prices.
Prices will go up. And we may be short a basket.
Betting prices are going to
go down. And that can be less risky than being long everything.
Right.
Because over time you see that the volatility is tremendously reduced by doing that type of strategy.
So a hedge fund essentially is taking a combination of people's investments, combining them together, and then making a portfolio of investments that either bet for prices going up or prices going down to hedge or offset the different degrees of risk to keep that fund growing and making money regardless of what happens.
Yes, and that's a key feature. It's a great diversifier. The way I would put it is many people have their own, you know, retirement accounts, and they have their investment portfolio set up. What they don't realize is most of them do have a certain percentage allocated to commodities, whether it's through ExxonMobil, Amerita Hess, or some sort of ETF that their financial advisor...
Define ETF.
Okay, so it's an exchange-traded fund, so it basically allows you to participate in the futures market through buying and selling normal everyday stocks. They don't sometimes move exactly the way the futures market does, and they do have some extreme fees. It can also function, an ETF can also allow you to purchase a basket of energy companies, which eliminates specific company risk. So you're
always exposed to industry and general risk instead of by having a basket of the different companies.
Right. But the important point is that commodities, whether you know it or not, are in your portfolio if you have a financial advisor. And so what EQS has...
Or even if you're putting in a 401k plan that has a mixed...
Exactly.
Right, because they're managing your 401k plan or your 403b or whatever all the plans are out there. If they're doing it, they're going to have a combination of assets of equity, debt, generally commodities out there to...
So we talk about it, you hear in the media all the time. If you listen to the rhetoric and open a newspaper, you may hear this bear and this bull thing. Well, what does all that mean? Well, a bear market essentially means, you think of a big clawing bear, it means the market's going down, and a bull is a big charging bull and the market's going up. We have been in one of the longest bull markets in history. Since we had the crash, the great financial crisis, our federal government has done everything to lessen that pain, and we've thrown a lot of stimulus at it, and it has really created this bull market.
All the QEs, the quantitative easings, no interest rates, essentially.
Correct.
All of those kind of things were things that were done to prop up a struggling economy.
So our message to our listeners is that is certainly changing. You can't have a bull market forever, and you can't have a bear market forever. We have a very cyclical economy, and as an economist, we study these, and that's just the nature. What goes up must come down, and it's a very simple law. It's been around for thousands of years. It just makes sense. Economies just can't continue to grow and grow forever. They have to pause.
There's a shift in either whatever is being produced. Generally, we switched from being manufacturing based to service based. Now we see a switch of some of the manufacturing coming back on shore. All of those kind of things are part of that cycle where people have to fall out of the marketplace, get retrained, find a new job in the new economy, and cycles through.
And that's happening in China right now, and that's part of it. It's creating this bull market from charging and this bear market from coming in. So as we see this volatility, and again, we said commodities was a leading indicator that there was going to be a change coming on, that this bull market could be starting to pause. And we are certainly seeing that right now as this bear market comes in and this fear comes in. And fear, what do we say? Uncertainty drives fear, and fear drives prices down. And we're seeing that in the market right now as prices are collapsing.
And markets will tend to get into a bull market. They'll tend to get overpriced at some point, and they'll have corrections over and above what, might be resulting. So we'll see daily fluctuations even in a bull market where things are getting corrected and repriced, essentially. But in a bear market, it says everything's got to change because of some economic factor or underlying fundamental that's there that says, okay, wait a minute, everything's slowing down. China doesn't need as much. They're not building. They're not demanding. Japan, India, third world countries, all of that stuff starts coming into play, and that starts shifting and things slow.
And as we live it, and we say it all the time, we live in a smaller and smaller world, and that is because, the internet, airplanes, everything is opened up the world. We're not in a
hackers.
That's right. Or in a very large global economy, which makes it a very small world. So what happens in one country affects all the other countries. So when we have this slowdown in building in China, you know, they demand less copper for wiring to wire these new skyscrapers. And so that hurts the producers in Australia that provide copper. So the copper companies come under pressure, and it
trickles
down.
Labor pressure. So if China starts having a population that goes on strike because they're not going to work for the wages and the conditions, they start being like the rest of the world and say, okay, I need more than 10 cents an hour or whatever they're paying. Then China has to deal with that. That destabilizes China. That reflects in the market, reflects on their demand. It can be really pretty much anything inside of a major player in the economies that triggers that little final glitch that puts us in a full bear market.
Right. And so that's what's really interesting. We didn't hear talk about the Federal Reserve and the new interest rate.
I made the comment before we came on air that I'm fed up, meaning the Fed needs to kind of step out of things.
Well, the big problem that we're seeing, you know, that we report on at EQS is it's not so much what the Fed does, it's what the Fed doesn't do. It's the not making a decision is driving uncertainty, and uncertainty provides fear in the markets, and that's why we're
right,
seeing a global problem.
They were pretty confident they were going to raise interest rates. Then they're not sure. Then somebody says they still should. And then they don't. And then they're going to announce it later. They're going to do this. They're going to do that.
And some people think they might even ease again at
right,
some point.
QE4 or QE204, which isn't now. I mean, but at some point, everyone has to go back and say either the economy is strong enough and everything goes back to what I used to consider normal, which was an interest rate. There was a cost of borrowing. The government wasn't borrowing as much. The capital was out there to flow to businesses, and the economy could grow from the private sector.
Right. So the great thing about the, at least the American economy, is we're a free market, and markets have an ability to
mostly
set prices.
Free.
Or the Chinese market, they have a lot of government intervention. And so we're seeing some abnormalities in what's been happening in the commodity sector spilling over to the rest of our sector because their government is intervening and not letting markets fluctuate how they should be. And so, you know, Greenspan had a great example. You know, what he would always talk about is the punch bowl. You know, when the party gets out of control, you take away the punch bowl, and the party dies down, right? People leave. And then when, you know, hey, it's time to kick this party up a notch again, let's throw some more punch out and the party starts.
And they usually spike it about that time too then.
Well, we've been in a long period of some spike punch and some people are starting to kind of stumble around.
And a lot of people have been drinking the Kool-Aid too. but when we look out there, if I'm a business on Main Street, I'm a small business, and I'm out there and I'm looking at, let's say I'm a delivery service or a pizza place and I have to pay for running, you know, my delivery vans and things, or a florist. I like the fact that the price of the pump's gone down. That helps my business. But long term, it kind of also starts signaling that something could start hurting my business, because that also means demand and other things are going to start being affected, right? So as prices go down, less drilling, the market's going to adjust, all that kind of thing. And so do I need to be looking at the commodities and trying to figure out, okay, what does it look like for me the rest of 2015? What do I plan for 2016? I love low gas prices, but does that mean there's going to be some other kind of whammy coming from the economy?
That's always the million-dollar question or the billion-dollar question.
He pulled out his crystal ball here for me.
So, you know, as an economist, we're the most hated people next to weathermen. You know, we certainly can't get it right.
It's probabilities.
We always leave an open-ended question. But, things are changing. We are a normal business cycle. Like we talk, you have a rise and then you have a fall. And we're currently at a peak of a business cycle, and we're starting to feel those effects, and we have a fall. So the Fed topic becomes interesting, and normally we would be taking away punch, so to speak, at
right,
this
we'd
point
raise
in time.
The interest rates, because, and then that would be taking the punch away.
Right. And so what we're seeing is just the opposite. So when
they're getting extra glasses.
Right. So when the party ends, you want to be putting back out the punch. And instead, the punch has already been out and been flowing for a long time. And so.
And they've forgotten where the tap is.
So we certainly see some problems there.
One of the things that, you know, you touched on is the uncertainty and kind of, you know, how things. How do you position yourself not knowing whether, you know, prices are going to rise, the economy is going to recover, or is it going to fall, or is there some other situation out there that you should be aware of to be preparing for now? Well, the way EQOS works, we talked about the importance of data. But one of the things we don't know is, 60, 100 days into the future. We bring in data every single day, and
right.
we compile it. And at the end of the day, it tells us for the very next day where prices are headed and what condition the economy is. So far, things are okay. The world's not going to end. Actually, the U.S. economy is doing quite well. And the demand outlook for certain commodities is fine. So it just so happens that those trends persist and they snowball over time, and those recommendations from the system tend to be long-term in nature. So at this point in time, this is kind of the way we view things. Now, the one other thing that's very important is, would you say there's differences in the economy now that there weren't, 5-10 years ago? Would you agree with
Definitely.
That?
Definitely.
And one of the things that we deal with that I kind of laugh about, have you ever heard in a financial statement, past performance is not indicative of future results? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. I used to think that was somewhat silly because, in my previous job at Coke, we would interview people and we would ask about specific things that they did in their past.
Right.
How they managed it, what was the outcome, and use that as a judge of character. And that helped us actually do fairly well at hiring the right people. And we went through a fairly large, extensive hiring process over and over again, and we got fairly good at it. Well, when I became more and more involved in trading, I saw this, and I wasn't really sure that I agreed with it. I was like, why wouldn't you want to know the history of performance of a financial advisor, and why wouldn't that be an indication? Well, one example of that is how the economy changes and how it evolves. And we've actually lived through that. I mean, we didn't just, develop a crystal ball and bam, it was ready to go. We went through several iterations and several trials and errors. And one of the hard lessons we had to figure out was the magnitude at which things have changed. And our initial version that came up with EQS was developed with back-tested over 15 years worth of data, and it actually showed that historical performance was great. But it didn't work in 2013.
Right.
Why? Well, we started digging into it. Technology has changed. There's a lot more algorithmic trading in the market, a lot of high-frequency trading. A lot of people who manage positions with stop losses are getting picked off by these high-frequency traders at a higher percentage than they were in the past, much higher. I'm talking about double, triple the amounts. And as an active trader, we manage our risk with stop losses, meaning if we're long or we bought oil at $47, we would put in a trade in there that says if it gets below 45, we don't want to absorb any more risk than that,
right.
So we're going to exit out. The problem is say there's 100 other investors doing the same thing we are. The algorithmic traders can see all those orders in there, and they know if they penetrate that.
And they move ahead.
And they move ahead. That massive selling is going to create a collapse, which they can buy back and make money. So that didn't exist 15
right.
years ago. So the data, my point is we had to develop a system that evolves and learns as the economy and technology changes. So we have incorporated dynamic parameters in our system that change. So the system, 5 years ago is not the same as today.
Right.
It was a huge leap in terms of how our structure was with the system, but we feel it's a good improvement. It's a good way to mitigate that risk.
Well, that's essentially the same thing that drives economies and supply and demand. When things shift, like I said, we were agricultural, then we were industrial, then we were manufacturing, and then we started switching into services. That shift frequently leaves people behind, right? What worked before no longer works. So I'll age myself once again on air that when PCs first started coming out, I was in third grade. So my uncle had one of the Radio Shack 80s, and so we started playing in third grade. We were one of the few kids that had a computer to play with back then. Now everybody and their two-year-old has a computer in their hand, either a smartphone, an iPad, tablet, something. So the more we don't keep current as businesses, as things change in the industry, we can't compete. right? And so we start seeing our competitor who is up to date on internet marketing or hiring practices or getting you millennials to produce some work. It's that kind of thing. We have to stay current. We have to have our own dynamic business models, and the parameters have to change. What worked last year may not work this year. And that's what you're saying about the financial model.
Right. So what we're exactly saying, when we said earlier, is we're living in a smaller and smaller world. And that goes back to that fact that we're living in a smaller world. Everything's integrated. So what happens in China, you know, has a way of trickling through the whole world economy.
And what happens on Wall Street impacts
Main Street. And it's vice versa. You know, the Volkswagen story is a great example of what's going on, because people don't realize.
So for the people who have not heard it, Volkswagen programmed it through software to pass the United States emissions tests and received all kinds of funding, shall we say, in return for meeting emissions standards. And so they have been caught actually failing emission standards, and it was actually a fraudulent effort, and the executive resigned. But there are ramifications.
Right. And so those play out to our broader commodities markets, and those play out to our broader stock markets, which is going to trickle down to Main Street. So something as simple as Volkswagen tried to cheat an emissions test, it has the following effects. Volkswagen's faced with $18 billion of fines. Okay, well, they have enough cash on their balance sheet to absorb that, and they're going to pay that, and their shareholders are going to take a hit. And their shareholders took a mighty hit. The company's lost about 30% of its value. But what happens is Volkswagen starts selling less cars. So what do they have to do? They have to do price incentives to try to get people in the doors of their dealerships.
So they're going to say, trust us again.
So right. By doing that, they are going to essentially put downward pressure on the rest of the automotive industry. So now General Motors and Ford, to compete with Volkswagen, guess what they're going to have to do?
They're going to have to
lower
match.
Prices. And so as they lower prices, there's less room and profits of those companies to pay wages out to employees, to pay suppliers. So those have a major trickle effect to the rest of the global economy on a whole.
Barring UAW contracts, that's true. Because the fact is, here in the States, price pressures put pressure on the profit, not necessarily on their cost structures, unless they're going to lay off a plant or do something
that's
of
true.
That nature. And so they have a more fixed cost structure here in the States versus other countries where they have unions, but they don't work like our unions.
So when you have a very high fixed cost, what does that translate into? You know, you've got to make that cost.
Well, and then the issue with the airbag recalls. I think there's supposed to be several more manufacturers coming up with the airbag recalls. So that industry in particular is near and dear to my heart, since I grew up in that industry. And early in my career, I worked for Ford, and we would do economics forecasts. We were forecasting out and buying 5-10 years out for aluminum and steel and other economics. And we had to be to the fourth decimal point of pricing at a minimum 10 years out when we were forecasting product costs.
It's a big deal. I mean, Alcoa, who is one of the poster childs of successful American industries, announced yesterday that they were going to be splitting their stock. And they're spinning off their whole aluminum division.
So for splitting stock means stock owners are going to receive 2-1 or 3-1.
No, in this case, they're actually splitting the company. So the aluminum division is going to spin off and be a separate division. Now, it once was, you know, a fantastic American industry. You know, as commodities have fallen, aluminum's one of the commodities that has been really hit hard. Aluminum, copper, steel, all those industries are affected by this demand.
But there's another shift, and price pressures are things that come into play. I know my client, I went down to Mexico, because historically Mexican companies were competing on price. Well, suddenly China and the other third world countries start coming online with lower prices. Mexico had to learn, those companies in Mexico had to learn to compete on something besides price, because they can no longer be the lowest price provider. And so going in and looking at those kind of things. So your business model shifts, your market model shift, and that ability to assess and be aware, even as a small business, looking at, you know, what's the commodities market expected to do today? What are the stock markets expected to do today? Why is that happening? How does that trickle down to my customers, my community, the economics that we're facing, and then what does it mean for my business and for me as an employer or as an employee or as a customer of a business?
Correct. And so we need to take all that data and a way to hedge that risk, you know, and those are the services that we provide our customers. So as Rick said, so through our EQS trading signals, we send out an email every day that has that recommendation of the basket's commodity. Should you essentially go long, which means should you be a buyer in this market, or should you go short? Should you be a seller of this market? You know, we have had a short on in the oil, in the products market, the diesel fuel market. And then, you know, we've taken nice profits on that. You know, we're starting to see things turn around. You know, do you then buy that? And we give those recommendations to our subscribers on a daily basis with that stop loss, because you have to be disciplined as a trader. You have to continue to, as Rick iterated, the markets are always changing, but you have to have a disciplined strategy with that, and a good strong stop loss is part of that. And we provide that to our subscribers, and we show them, when you enter the market at this price with this stop loss over this time, and you follow our recommendations, you will make this profit.
So if they're going to EQSTrading.com, they get to see options to subscribe to both newsletters, the free and the paid?
They will get a free subscription for a period of time for 30 days, which will encompass both the newsletter, which is weekly, and the daily signals that go out. And they complement each other. One is, you know, the daily signals is every day the model updates and gives you the latest information you need on the direction of commodities. The newsletter is very important, as it just adds just a little bit of commentary that explains
those high-level summaries.
Those high-level summaries of why the decisions were made to go long and short, basically.
So if anyone wants to visit your website, it's eqstrading.com. Is there another website, an email?
eqscapital.com. If you're interested in the hedge fund for our accredited investors, you know, we'll certainly be willing to talk to you about investing in a hedge fund and what that entails.
Got a phone number you want them to call?
Sure. Yes. They can reach us at our office, which is area code 919-714-7453.
All right, guys. Thanks. And that does us for Focus on Business this week. And until next time, everybody, stay focused on the important things.
Our community. Focus Resources supports Focus on Business and is our underwriter for today's program. We'd like to thank Focus Resources, and if you'd like to learn more about this organization that supports WCFM and underwrites Focus on Business, you can visit their website, focusresourcesinc.com. Thanks to Focus Resources and all the station's underwriters. Focus on Business and WCOM-FM are proud to support the Ronald McDonald House of Durham. To learn more about the Ronald McDonald House of Durham, visit their website at www.ronaldhousedurham.org. That's www.ronaldhousedurham.org, or give them a call at 919-281-1065. WCOM FM and Focus on